for the sound of hoofbeats on the ice.
If you need me, I will be nearby, mountain high, valley low. My love follows you until the last, lightning fast, turtle slow. Journey to the North Star, south wind blows my thoughts to you. If you need me, I will be nearby, mountain high, valley low. I'll be with you though our fortunes sway, lantern gay, willow sad. Spring will stroll our meadow every day, winter gray, summer glad. When your hair turns snow white, you will find me by your side. I'll be with you though our fortunes sway, lantern gay, willow sad. If you need me, I will be nearby, mountain high, valley low. That song was originally sung by Mary Martin in a less than successful show called Lute Song. They introduced to Broadway audiences a young male talent by the name of Yul Brynner. I sang it for you tonight in honor of my mother, Marjorie Mock Gregory, who would have been 100 years old today. She made it almost to 98, which is a pretty darn good run. I still miss her, but I marvel at how lucky, how blessed I was to have her around until I was over 60, and even at the end, to have the chance to say goodbye. Mom loved Broadway. She was especially fond of Mary Martin. So I thought this song would be a good choice for tonight. Also, Mom was fiercely loyal. And that was nicely expressed in the lyrics. Oh, Mom, I've been thinking about you all day today. And thank you for my childhood, for my life, for being my mom. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream Radio Show, and we're streaming live on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. It's listener-supported radio, so be sure to visit freedomslips.com and see if you can't help them out a little bit. It's a great network with lots of very, very good shows. And now I'm proud to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Palachek, an American writer.
Chuck, tonight we welcome special guests Richard Flamer, Jim Fetzer, and Susan Lindauer. And so tonight we're joining together for the New American Dream Radio Show in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, Duluth, Minnesota, Chiapas, Mexico, Madison, Wisconsin, Tacoma Park, Maryland, and wherever you are. Actually, Richard Flamer might be in Iowa. He might be still up here. He might be in Mexico. I'm not sure. My recommendations from around the internet. One is Wolfgang Halbig on Memory Hole blog. In this brief video excerpt from Wolfgang Halbig's most recent Freedom of Information hearing on June 3rd in Dander, in Newtown, First Electman, Patricia Lodra states that the "everyone must check in" sign prominently displayed outside the Sandy Hook Elementary School grounds on December 14, 2012, was placed there by the Department of Homeland Security. The Corbett Report, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, Corbett Report, looked for The Secret Life of Timothy McVeigh. And you can hear a recording or a blurb, an excerpt of McVeigh himself when he says, "We would be government-paid assassins." And always, Kevin Barrett and Jim Fetzer, False Flag Weekly News, each Thursday on No Lies Radio. Another good one is Wendy Painting, P-A-I-N-T-I-N-G, Wendy Painting on Revere Radio, talking about the Oklahoma City bombing. And Kevin Barrett interview with journalist Paul Williams on No Lies Radio, talking about, among other things, how Pope John Paul I was assassinated and his successor, John Paul II, though ostensibly shot by Mehmet Ali Aka, was really the target of a CIA hit. And U.S. intelligence responds, no comment, to questions of the U.S. government knowingly supporting the Islamic State, ISIS, at globalresearch.ca. Documents obtained by Judicial Watch via a lawsuit filed by the Watchdog organization against the Defense Intelligence Agency revealing that the U.S. government was not only well aware of the fact that Al-Qaeda ISIS made up the bulk of the so-called opposition in Syria, but that the U.S. supported these terrorist organizations in their drive to create an Islamic State in Syria and Iraq. And now we continue with our mini-series regarding A Trumpet to Arms, Alternative Media in America. It's a book. The culmination of all this is Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett in the False Flag Weekly News on No Lies Radio every Thursday. They are the evolved media. We know that today's newspapers, radio, TV are garbage, as well as the current version of what passes for alternative media, The Nation, The Progressive, NPR, Alternate, Rachel Maddow, Justin Raimondo, Seymour Hersh, David Swanson, Amy Goodman, Jon Stewart. If not garbage, at least suspicious, very suspicious. But what we want to say is something in this mini-series about the history of the alternative press, the beginnings that have evolved into Fetzer and Barrett. More from the book by David Armstrong. Although it didn't offer the novelty and extravagant promise of video technology, underground radio was an exciting medium in the 1960s, giving voice to new left politics, countercultural values, and innovative rock music at a time when mainstream radio affirmed the growing sense of community among young listeners, becoming what McLuhan termed their tribal drum. The roots of the 60s underground radio can be traced to 1949, when a small group of pacifists and libertarians founded KPFA-FM in Berkeley as the nation's first non-commercial listener-sponsored radio station. The birth was not without complications. FM receivers were so rare at that time that the station had to sell sets to potential listeners. With only $15,000 in the bank, KPFA was also undercapitalized, so much so that the station was forced to shut down for lack of funds after only a year on the air. In desperation, KPFA turned to its listeners for additional support, and in a matter of months, the station was back on the air, still with a shoestring budget, but back on the air. In 1951, KPFA's survival was ensured when the fledgling station was awarded a $150,000 grant from the Ford Foundation for a three-year study of listener-sponsored radio. Station KPFA and its parent Pacifica Foundation were the creations of Lou Hill, a World War II conscientious objector and a former American Civil Liberties Union official. Many of KPFA's early supporters and programmers were professors at the nearby University of California. Their collective knowledge gave the new station quality programming unmatched by many wealthier commercial stations and even by much network programming. KPFA was a horn of plenty, offering classical and popular music from around the world, live drama, and other cultural programming to go with in-depth documentaries and news broadcasts that were notable. The station was always broke and rent with internal strife among its talented, egotistical, underpaid staff, but it produced unique and exciting radio. The station survived Hill's suicide in 1957, won a coveted Peabody Award in 1958 for public service, and continued to attract top-notch talent. Alan Watts and Kenneth Rexroth appeared as commentators. Paul Robeson and Pete Seeger sang out, and the young Pauline Kael served as film critic. KPFA also had a unique ability to take and defend unpopular stands at a time when most of its commercial competitors remained discreetly silent. In 1954, several anonymous marijuana smokers defended the evil weed in a remarkable live program. Years later, assessing the early years of KPFA in an interview with City Miner magazine, Lawrence Ferlinghetti remembered, "KPFA had a large influence in the 50s. This was before everyone had a TV. KPFA was really a focal point for a lot of the underground. When I arrived in San Francisco in 1951, it was in full force. It was the center of the intellectual community right up on through the early 60s. There were regular commentators and programs that gave me a complete education that was much better than anything I got out of college. I mean, I used to listen to Alan Watts and Kenneth Rexroth regularly. For 10 years, KPFA was the only listener-sponsored radio station in America. It accepted no advertising, although it did take federal grants. The backbone of the station was its listenership, its electronic community. They paid most of the bills. In 1959, this lonely crowd got a bit bigger when Pacifica started KPFK in Los Angeles. That same year, an eccentric billionaire named Louis Schweitzer called Pacifica's general manager and offered the astonished executive his radio station, WBAI, in New York, simply because he admired Pacifica's programming. WBA signed on the air as Pacifica's third station in 1960. From A Trumpet to Arms, Alternative Media in America, continuing next week.
And now we bring you the Charles Bukowski Target and Walmart Father's Day Card Special American Collection. Tell those American dads around you what you really think of them. A card designed with you in mind. Some sample selections from the Bukowski Target Walmart Father's Day Special American Collection.
Sometimes you climb out of bed in the morning and you think, I'm not going to make it. But you laugh inside, remembering all the times you felt that way. We're all going to die, all of us. What a circus. That alone should make us love each other, but it doesn't. We are terrorized and flattened by trivialities. We are eaten up by nothing. There is a loneliness in this world so great that you can see it in the slow movement of the hands of a clock. People so tired, mutilated either by love or no love. People just are not good to each other one-on-one. The rich are not good to the rich. The poor are not good to the poor. We are afraid. Our educational system tells us that we can all be big-ass winners. It hasn't told us about the gutters or the suicides or the terror of one person aching in one place alone, untouched, unspoken to, watering a plant.
I couldn't get myself to read the want ads. The thought of sitting in front of a man behind a desk and telling him that I wanted a job, that I was qualified for a job, was too much for me. Frankly, I was horrified by life. What a man had to do simply in order to eat, sleep, and keep himself clothed. So I stayed in bed and drank. When you drank, the world was still out there, but for the moment, it didn't have you by the throat.
The problem was you had to keep choosing between one evil or another, and no matter what you chose, they slice a little bit more off you. Until there was nothing left. At the age of 25, most people were finished. A whole goddamn nation of assholes driving automobiles, eating, having babies, doing everything in the worst way possible, like voting for the presidential candidate who reminded them most of themselves.
It's true that I didn't have much ambition, but there ought to be a place for people without ambition. I mean a better place than the one usually reserved. How in the hell could a man enjoy being awakened at 6:30 a.m. by an alarm clock, leap out of bed, dress, force feed, crap, piss, brush teeth and hair, fight traffic to get to a place where essentially you made lots of money for somebody else and were asked to be grateful for the opportunity to do so?
You would be a really terrible father. You would be the average American citizen male breadwinner, and he is a horror to behold. He is a sight to make one vomit blood and gut and hope all out. For even when he smiles, even when he is kind, even when he is a winner, a lover, a father, a playboy, a champ, he stinks. He is rot. He is a flower without a head, a plant without root, a slab of meat butchered and dressed in clothing. Charles Bukowski, letter to Douglas Blazek, and screams from the balcony.
The Charles Bukowski Target and Walmart Father's Day Card Special American Collection. A card designed with you in mind. What's on deck at your local movie theater for the big summer season? Those crazy CIA lone nut shooters. The Waco kids burned alive. 9/11, what really happened? roundup at the OKC Murrah Corral. Operation Northwoods. Gulf of Tonkin. Buried at Sea. MLK, RFK, JFK. Wellstone, killed by Cheney Hit Squad. It's the new Hollywood lineup for the coming year, because you know what? We don't need the military or CIA to okay every film we make. We're actors, paid, big time, famous, celebrity, comfortable. Oh. Well, you know, whoops, no room, old cutting room floor, you know, but you're going to dig the new Tom Hanks film. Lee Harvey Oswald did it alone, nobody else, just him, from Warner Brothers. Already nominated for Best Picture, the Nobel Peace Prize, and Oprah's List.
Our first guest of the evening is Richard Flamer. Richard Flamer will be coming to us from, often, most often it's from Chiapas, his home in Chiapas, Mexico, but I think that Richard might still be up here in Iowa doing construction work to make money for the house down in Mexico. So well, when we talk to him, we'll find out where he's at. So Chuck will get Richard on the phone right about now.
Hello.
Well, hello, Richard. It's Chuck and Mike and the New American Dream Radio Show, and you are on the air.
Oh, great. As I mentioned the last time we talked, my wife came up to the United States to be with me in Iowa. She was most interested in getting away for a vacation, although it's the way things have worked out, it's not a big vacation, but that's okay. Araceli, her name is Araceli Benitez Moya. It's originally from Ixtaltepec, Oaxaca. That's southern Oaxaca in Mexico. And she came to visit, really, the Catholic worker in Des Moines, Iowa. This is her third visit to the U.S., and she tells me she's filled with wonder all the time. She enrolled in a class for English as a second language, though for her it's actually her third. She speaks Zapoteco, an indigenous language, and her primary language is Spanish. Her class is filled with immigrants. For her, it is astonishing that so many countries are represented in her studies. There are Laotians, Hondurans, Cambodians, Kenyans, Somalis, Arabs, Puerto Ricans. Just in her class alone, through contact at the school, she's also met Burmese and Nepali and Vietnamese peoples. She learned the bus schedules and is astonished at the friendliness of not only the drivers, but also all the passengers, many of whom are eager to help if she has questions. She works with the other Catholic workers in providing hospitality and two meals each day. She constantly circulates among the guests and tries to speak at length with the Spanish speakers, and sometimes in English. The Des Moines worker runs on donations of food, clothing, and sundries. Araceli has been prompt in arranging donated clothing, getting it out as soon as it comes in. She is also selecting pieces for herself, but mostly for her friends back in Chiapas and, of course, the local folks. The hardest part for her is in seeing the quantity, quality, and cost of the food that gets donated. The fruit, grains, and meats from the local Trader Joe's, or the bread, grains, and pastries from our local Whole Foods market are usually just about a week away from being out of date. But the quantity is incredible, and the quality. I mean, there's pieces of salmon, and there's range, open range beef and steaks and pork roast, all organic and all very expensive. And she can't imagine why people would not buy it until she looks at the price. But the other thing she can't understand is that with all that food and the healthy food that it is, there are such great problems of obesity here, especially with our guests and the people on the street who don't much care for whole grain breads. And when the white bread comes in, it goes out as fast as it comes in. But the healthier foods just don't go out as regularly. We talk each night about excess as the American way. Yet she also talks to migrants about the opportunities she sees. The first being that no one need go hungry in Des Moines. There are actually a good dozen places where her friends in her class can go to get food so that they have milk and cheese and bread and canned goods from all of those places. She's been helping out as well at our dispensary on Saturdays. Every Saturday we go to a local church and in the basement give out almost a ton of fresh fruit and vegetables that are from a fruit and vegetable company that distributes them to local markets. And rather than have them go to waste, the people bring them by the Catholic worker, and we give them out every Saturday. Most of the recent migrants in her class have relatively new cars, which she can't understand since we drive a ratty old pickup. Additionally, there are two blind immigrants who've gotten Braille devices and are being assisted with apartments, including the stipend and job training, which he thinks is very generous of the state of Iowa, which I also think is very generous. They happen to be Puerto Rican, and so she talks to them almost every day. I tend to lose sight of those virtues of American life, concentrating on my more negative cultural views. Access to health care for the poor is much better in the Midwest than in the past. Many of the ethnic barriers are breaking down, especially with state governments. The driver's license information booklets, along with the exams, are available in 20 different languages. Marriage licenses are $35 with no real obstacles for gay, straight, foreign, or domestic. This is in distinction from Mexico, where a civil marriage must happen before a judge. When Araceli and I married, we actually went before three judges, two of whom refused to marry us because we were mixed race. That is, because she was an indigenous woman and I'm an old white guy. The third judge was the first Indian judge appointed in the state and married us on his first day in office, of course, for a $200 fee for the marriage license, which might explain why most of the people we know are not married in view of the state. For her, it's a strange experience here, though she really likes it. In the afternoons and the days that we're not open with the Catholic worker, she heads over to go with a woman friend who knows where all the Salvation Army stores and all the secondhand stores are located. So the two of them comb through the newest merchandise and collect everything they need or think they need. And the good news about Araceli is she rarely buys anything for herself. It's mostly for her sisters or her friends. And it recently got hot here in Iowa up in the 90s. So she found me a bunch of T-shirts at 99 cents. And that's just her way. It's interesting, and she's having a hard time in the class, but she's learning a lot of English fairly quickly. We're discovering that the immigration process is pretty difficult for her to become either a naturalized citizen or a long-term resident. She has a tourist visa, which allows her to come for up to 6 months at a time and then go back. But she'd like to be able to work while she's here. So we're in the process of trying to find out what she needs to do, but the immigration process is so screwed up. And part of the problem, it seems, is that she'd have to come here to be a citizen. She'd have to come here and stay for 2 years continuously and not go back to Mexico, which neither of us wants. So we keep muddling through all this stuff and trying to figure out the best way to live. And we seem to be doing a pretty good job of it, although I do miss Chiapas, as does she. But she'll be heading back at the end of June, and I'll be on a plane, and I'll be flying, or I'll be driving an old pickup back filled with tools for the wood shop I'm working on. I don't want her to travel through the drug zone up in the north where so many killings have occurred. So she's going by plane. I just recently read where in the 3 years that this new president, Peña, has been in power, there have been just over 60,000 deaths, drug-related, the narco traffickers, usually killing between various gangs or cartels, but there's been a lot of civilians included in that, so I don't want to have her worry about driving through. I don't want to worry about her driving through there, so I'll do that alone probably. And that's the latest here from Des Moines, and by the time I have the next interview, I'm assuming I'll be back in Chiapas. At least I hope so.
Well, we certainly hope you'll have a safe trip back, Richard. Can you remind listeners real quick of how they can donate to you? It sounds like we're about out of time here.
Sure. The Chiapas Project, care of Holy Family Catholic Church, 1715 Izzard Street, Omaha, Nebraska, 68102. And thanks again.
Thank you, Richard, bye. And you have a real safe trip.
Okay, bye.
All right, thank you.
Now stay tuned for the continuing adventures of Troy the Town Cop. Troy was sitting in the cruiser brushing donut hole dust off his new blue pants. He was over on the side street over by the ball field listening to the high school's Saturday afternoon basketball report on the local radio station when he got a call. Something about an explosion over by the church on Elm Street. Troy turned on the siren and the lights, and it wasn't long before he could see the smoke. Lots and lots of smoke. Black smoke rising straight up. There were cars burning in the parking lot and a big hole in the church roof where the smoke and fire danced. Troy ran inside, beginning his full day of helping to save the living, cover the dead, and comfort the dying. Amid the brick and steel and wood church rubble, the wedding was canceled as the bride and groom and most of the wedding party were among the casualties. The guests eventually went home walking, limping, or hobbling along in vehicles with flat tires and blown out windows. It was Troy who discovered the remains of one of the rockets that some said had come from a silent, pilotless aircraft above our town. Troy rubbed away the blood and dirt to find an inscription on the spent bomb. Greetings from the USA and Barack Obama. When Troy finally got home, he was too tired to shower. He yanked a beer from the fridge and snatched the bowl of stale chips off the counter and stumbled into the living room. He felt in the dark for the clicker and turned on the news right in time for coverage of the whole church thing. And there he was, hurrying around, jumping over a little broken stone wall. He pointed the beer can at the TV and sort of smiled as he kicked off his boots at the same time. The TV announcers explained for their listeners that the members of the wedding party had been terrorists, a sleeper hidden cell. The bride and groom had been known to do anti-American terroristic things. One of them was the number two person in the organization. This will deeply inhibit their ability to operate for quite some time, said the TV announcer. Troy popped the top, looked at the clock on the wall, pointed the clicker, and switched to the college baseball game.
And now stay with us for more of the adventures of Troy the Town Cop. Troy the Town Cop was sitting in the Hardee's parking lot looking for speeders when he got a call to go check out some guys with assault rifles over by the elementary school. Some guys in blaze orange and camo, boots, plaid ear flap caps, gloves, sitting in the soccer net. They say they're duck hunting. But hunting season isn't till... We got every right. Well, yeah, I know. Second Amendment. Yeah, I know. But the elementary school? Why not out on the river? It's the principal, man, don't you see? Well, I gotta have your guns. And you can't sit here at school property. Yeah, okay, we didn't think you'd be like this, Troy. I thought we were in this together. So Troy, the town cop, takes the guy's guns and waits in the squad until he sees them roar off in the blaze orange F-150. And now he's got all these guns in the back seat and he can't go have coffee at McDonald's because now everyone's pissed at him. What's he going to do? He's got to live here for about 100 years yet with these guys. Well, Troy rolled down the window, smoked a cigarette, got out of the cruiser, opened the back door, and then drove off again. Slow, speeding up and swerving every now and again. Dropping a shotgun or an assault rifle into the street. One about every block. In about a week, all the guns got back into the hands of their rightful owners, and Troy was back enjoying his coffee breaks at McDonald's. Not outside in the parking lot, but right inside in the booth with all the guys. Troy looked down at his coffee cup that he was gripping tight with both hands, leaving indentations in the styrofoam. The only way they're getting this cup, he thought to himself, would be to rip it from my cold, dead fingers. He smiled and looked up to laugh at a joke he'd heard before. Join us next time for the adventures of Troy the Town Cop, when we'll find Troy being called to a high school kegger in the woods, and finding only a crashed 69 Chevrolet Lunar Lander and a lonely alien sitting on a stump, singing, I am a lineman for the county. And drinking Boone's Farm, Strawberry Hill.
Now please join us for another episode of Carl and Buster, the last of the paper boys. The last of the paper boys is sponsored every week by the good folks at Winston Cigarettes and Wild Turkey Whiskey. Now sit back and be quiet as we zoom in on Mount Liberty, Nebraska in the great American westerly Midwest. Somewhere between Iowa and Colorado, out on the prairie, the big grain elevators, the barbed wire fence, the cows, the corn, the newspaper carriers, all that stuff. You want some gun? Some gum? Carl held out the hard gum from the baseball card package.
Nah, you go ahead, said Buster. I can't chew that stuff anymore. My teeth just can't take it.
Carl folded the gum and stuck it into his mouth, perhaps more carefully than he had before. Carl and Buster sat on their Stingray bikes outside the newspaper office door, kickstands down, leaning back, lounging on their banana seats up against the sissy bar. Carl's kickstand was actually broken. He used the parking meter for support just as well.
Carl and Buster came to work as paper boys for the Daily News back in the early 1960s when they were both in elementary school. It was a big deal. Not every kid got hired, you know. They liked the idea of having a real job, some money, so they actually made it on their own. And they talked about how they liked the fresh smell of the ink and being up close with the whole idea of the newspaper business. They saw a reporter out covering a high school basketball game or drove past the Daily News building with relatives after the big Thanksgiving meal, and they could say they worked there. And over the years, well, the other kids quit, graduated to middle school, junior high, senior high, college, got other jobs, got married, bought a big house out in the west part of town, had kids. Carl and Buster trained lots of those kids into being good paper boys. And then eventually the kids of those kids as well. The young ones won't stick with it. They stay a few months, that's usually it, until they join Little League or get a better gig shoveling snow or carrying groceries at Superfood.
But Carl and Buster loved the newspapers, wished they could have been Charles Schultz or Jimmy Breslin or a big publisher, even a small one. But this was okay. This was our foot in the door, a part of the action. You get to read the news and sports first. Well, but of course now everyone already knew it 9 hours ago. But still, well, shoot, they're happy. How many people can really say that?
Buster thought once or twice about leaving, getting away from Mount Liberty, doing something different. Maybe going to Omaha or Lincoln, delivering the Journal Star or World Herald. But he didn't. And then that one year he tried to get Carl to move with him to New York City and deliver the Times or the Post. They were going to do it, too. For a whole week, they talked about how they would ride their bikes to New York. Then they thought for another whole week about how they would get their bikes on a bus or an airplane. And then without really deciding, they just stopped talking about it. Once they got their pictures on the front page of the Daily News on newspaper carrier week, sitting on their bikes. That was a big deal. Once they got their pictures on page 5, a reprint from a story in the World Herald as the oldest carriers in Nebraska. Well, that was over 12, 15, maybe 25 years ago now, it seems. Maybe. Every day except Sunday, rainy, windy, snowy, sunny, they sit outside the Daily News gray steel back door, wait for the door to get unlocked. They take turns getting up and checking every 5 minutes or so. Then they go down and wait for their bundles to come down the metal chute. Then they work on the big metal tables, folding their papers, putting them neatly, strategically into their cloth bags that fit over their shoulders. If one gets done first, the other helps. Their routes are in the same section of town, and they ride together till they get to Elm Street. Then they split up.
News nerds, they call themselves. They actually have favorite editions, like some other guys have favorite cars or football teams. Some folks know each episode of Happy Days or Gilligan's Island or the Dukes of Hazzard or the 65 Packers or Stairway to Heaven word for word. Carl and Buster know news. At home, on their bedroom walls, they have special ones, the best, most important papers in real frames.
Reggie Jackson, 4 home runs and 4 at-bats in the 1977 World Series against the Dodgers in one game. John Lennon shot. Mount St. Helens erupts. The Vietnam War ends. The Packers win the Super Bowl. Again. Man on the moon. Princess Diana killed. Bill Clinton in big trouble. The Beatles hit New York City. United States attacked.
And both of them had smack dab center right on their bedroom doors, the Daily News front page from November 23rd, 1963. Kennedy is dead.
And neither of them knows it about the bedroom door of the other guy. And they don't ever talk about it. Too sad. Too much. Just way too much.
Nobody reads papers anymore. The Daily News is getting thinner and thinner both ways, thick and sideways. Everybody is on their computer or their phone. Carl tells Buster it's because the Daily News doesn't tell the truth. Never did.
Buster doesn't believe that. Won't listen to it. So Carl doesn't bring it up very often. Maybe once a decade. But it's the truth, he says. They don't tell the truth about Oswald or Waco or Oklahoma City, JFK, RFK, MLK, or Wellstone, or 9/11 or Iraq, or the moon. None of that. So people just know the only thing they tell the truth about is ninth grade football.
Buster says that's probably enough. You can only go so far, and then that's far enough. And it is nice not to have such heavy papers easier on the back, especially when a guy gets older. But it makes Carl and Buster wonder about how long they'll have their jobs to be able to go out, help the other guy go collect after dark with their punches and flip cards and heavy canvas pouches, and then be able to go spend a quarter or a dollar down at the Dairy Queen before having to get home. They talk about getting other jobs, but who would hire them? All they know is the paper biz. And so they decide to stay, without ever really saying it.
They throw their paper bags, stained with ink, strawberry ice cream, and cherry Coke, over their heads, and pedal down the street. They ride with no hands down the middle of the street till they see a car coming. They ride past all the people who know them, waving, honking, smiling at them like they were in a parade. One of them once said to the other that the worst thing in the world would be if they stayed their whole life in this one place, this one town, this one job. The other had said, that sounded like the best thing to him.
And now they probably don't remember who said what or that it ever came up. At Fifth and Elm, they swerve apart like skiers who take different paths down the hill for a while, knowing they'll meet up at the end.
See you, says Buster.
See you later, Carl hollers, pulling on the butterfly handlebars to stand up at the pedal, then letting himself back down slowly.
Tune in next week for The Last of the Paper Boys, when we will hear Buster say, what was that?
And Carl says, I didn't hear anything, did you? Our next guest of the evening is Jim Fetzer. Chuck will be lining up Jim's interview, and Jim Fetzer comes to us each month from his home in Madison, Wisconsin. Also, Jim is on.
Mike and Chuck, it's a great pleasure to be back on with you again, especially when I am announcing the publication of the second book in our series, inspired by Mike Palachek, Save the World, Resist the Empire. The first was the dynamic duo White Rose Blooms in Wisconsin. The second I announce now, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, the Beatles, the Holocaust, and other mass illusions. This is a truly fascinating collaborative effort with 13 different contributors, inspired by Mike Palachek, edited by me, produced by Ole Domegaard, where the front and the back covers really are intended as arguments part of the case. When we see the walls of a gas chamber, presumably, but they aren't turned blue. And where we see photos of Paul and Fall, of the real Saddam and a double of the actual Osama and a fake. And on the back cover, photos of Paul with Jane Asher and a Fall with Jane Asher. Let me read from the back cover. William Casey, director of the CIA, was reported to have told his staff, "Our disinformation campaign will be a success when everything the American people believe is false." And they seem to have done a pretty good job of it, where this book explains how we know that we did not go to the moon, but faked it. That Paul McCartney died and was replaced. That we hung a double, not Saddam. That Osama died in Afghanistan, not Pakistan. That the Holocaust was different than historians claim. This book challenges some of our most cherished and deeply held beliefs. Just to expand on Paul McCartney, there has been a considerable discussion and debate within the Beatles cultural community about the possibility that, given so many clues appear to occur in relation to the Sgt. Pepper album and elsewhere, that Paul McCartney may have died in 1966 and been replaced, where this book substantiates that indeed that is the case, that Paul McCartney appears to have died in an automobile accident on September 11th, coincidentally, 1966. The following month, Brian Epstein, their manager, declared the Beatles would no longer be touring. And on the 5th of July, they released the Sgt. Pepper album, which the evidence adduced here suggests was in fact a funeral. You have a gravesite with the name Beatles spelled out in roses. You have the lads in black to the side. You have the new resplendent Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band introducing the one and only Billy Shears, who is noticeably taller than was Paul, hence the photograph on the back cover of Paul with Jane Asher and a fall with Jane Asher, where he's half a head taller, but where I must admit, even I myself was uncertain whether we were talking about two persons or only one, until I encountered the forensic study done by two Italian scientists who set off to establish that, in fact, there was only one Paul James McCartney, but wound up proving precisely the opposite, using photographs of their open mouths from singing occasions. They discovered that Paul had a narrow palate and poor teeth, that his replacement had excellent teeth and a broad palate. They also discovered differences in the shape and size of their skulls, and differences in their ears, and as I've already observed, differences in their height. It's an absolutely fascinating story where there are four brilliant chapters here on the entire saga, which one contributor has observed is by far the Beatles' greatest mystery. The forensic evidence is included as a chapter of its own. Well, the moral of the story is, not only do we find this intrinsically, intellectually fascinating, but if you could replace perhaps the most closely observed person in the world and get away with it, then substituting a double for Saddam Hussein or faking someone else for Osama bin Laden in a compound in Pakistan are comparative pieces of cake, where the book explains in great detail how those were done, where Saddam, in fact, was taken out by a B-1 bomber pilot on April 7th, 2003, only 3 weeks into the Iraq invasion, that George Bush intended to announce it on the mission accomplished event aboard the USS Lincoln off the coast of San Diego, but where a member of the administration, whom we believe was Donald Rumsfeld, Secretary of State, realized that three presidents, Reagan, Carter, and Ford, had signed executive orders precluding the assassination of a foreign head of state. So they had to deny that he had actually been killed, even though Dick Cheney even was quoted in no less a source than the New York Times as saying, "I think we got Saddam, his body was pulled out of the rubble and he wasn't breathing." And where the case of substitution was made, claimed to have been found in a spider hole, was placed on trial and hung, but it wasn't the real Saddam. If you want the full story, you can read it here. And where the event, the raid on the compound in Pakistan in 2011, was intended to secure Barack Obama's triumphal reelection by claiming the tip had come from Guantanamo because the base was still open, not really his fault. Republicans wouldn't let him close it everyone said, "Aren't we glad it's still open?" Using troops stationed in Pakistan, for which he had been severely criticized, it would be said, "Oh, aren't we glad they were there?" And while his birth certificate from Hawaii, which appears to be fraudulent, had been the object of derision by many right-wing talk show hosts, it was swept off of their discussion table, and Barack Obama was positioned as the man who got the most wanted man in the world. The fact of the matter is, however, that Osama bin Laden had nothing to do with 9/11. When he was first asked about it, he explained that it was against the tenets of the Quran to murder innocent women and children, that while he was opposed to the stationing of American forces in Saudi Arabia, the home of Mecca and Medina, the two most holy sites in Islam, that this appeared to have been done by a government within the government that wanted to blame this on Muslims, where no less an authority than William Jefferson Clinton has echoed the same sentiment. "There's a government within the government, and I don't control it," Bill Clinton is quoted as having said. The cases with regard to the moon landing and the Holocaust are utterly fascinating and include objective scientific evidence that we did not go to the moon but faked it, and that the alleged concentration camps were in fact labor camps where Zyklon B was used for the purpose of delousing, killing body lice, which were responsible for the spread of disease, not for murdering inmates. And where we know that bodies that die from cyanide poisoning, where Zyklon B is a mild form, turn pink, and that the walls of chambers used for that purpose interacting with the Zyklon B turn blue. But we have no reports of pink bodies, and the only chambers that turn blue were those used for delousing. There is much more to the story. Will you find four of the most powerful chapters ever published about the Holocaust in this book? And where we begin with the issues about the moon landing, where NASA rather shot itself in the foot by announcing just 2 years ago that the greatest obstacle to a manned mission to Mars was transiting the Van Allen radiation belt, as though it were a new thing and hadn't been present as a feature of Earth and its immediate surroundings since its creation approximately 4.5 billion years ago. If the Van Allen radiation belt is a problem today, it was a problem then and is a major reason. But we have a host of other anomalies, including photographs of moon landers with no tracks in front, no tracks behind. Moon rovers with no tracks in front, no tracks behind. We have a moon lander where there's no excavation of dust from beneath the lander where its jets would have blown it out. No dust.
Thanks to Jim Fetzer. This message is from Harper Random Collins Bantam Simon Penguin and Schuster, America's book publisher. You've heard of the Harry Potter series. Well, that author's retired, and that's left a big gap on the Walmart bookshelf. So we're pleased to announce the Killing Ben series by the Navy SEALs who did or will do the killing, just like killing Ben Laden. We think you'll love the tales of terror, adventure, and terror. We think you will eat up Killing Ben Cohen and Killing Ben Affleck. There'll be low-light bar scenes, fast fingers finding passwords on really cool computers, Tom Cruise running fast, Killing Ben Roethlisberger, Killing Ben Franklin, Killing Ben Stiller. There will be car chases and people jumping out of fast pickups on county back roads with country music playing, animated jumping over mooses and squirrels, Killing Big Ben, Killing Bed Bernanke, Killing Ben Hogan, There will be books and movies and coffee mugs, T-shirts and tiny toys. Killing Ben Stein, Ben Kingsley, and Benjamin Netanyahu. Benjamin Harrison, Benny Goodman, Ben Gazzara, and Uncle Ben's Rice. Look for the Killing Ben series in your Walmart aisle soon. How it was done. By the Navy SEALs who were there, will be there soon. In on the action right up close. It's true. There will be T-shirts. Killing Bo Peep. Killing Quasimodo. Killing Cruella. And Captain Hook, too.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. Hello, everyone. Now for your local Earth news. This is Chuck Gregory and Mike Palachuk with a review of today's news from the eye of the hurricane and the eye of the blizzard. The military in the U.S. portrays itself as endowed with the highest virtues, honor, duty, self-sacrifice, courage, and patriotism. Politicians, entertainers, sports stars, the media, clerics, and academics slavishly bow before the military machine, ignoring its colossal pillaging of state resources, the egregious war crimes it has normalized across the globe, its abject service not to democracy or freedom, but corporate profit, and the blind, mind-numbing obedience it inculcates among its members. A lone soldier or Marine who rises up inside this system to denounce the hyper-masculinity that glorifies violence and war, who exposes the false morality of the military, who refuses to kill in the service of imperial power, unmasks the military for what it is. And he or she, as Chelsea Manning has learned, swiftly pays a very, very heavy price.
Specialist Robert Weilbacher is a new Army combat medic stationed in South Korea, listened to stories told by combat veterans, many suffering from trauma and depression about the routine and indiscriminate slaughter of civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was horrified. He believed the propaganda fed to him over the years. He considered himself a patriot. He'd accepted the notion that the U.S. military was a force for good, intervening to liberate Iraqis and Afghans and fight terrorists. But after hearing the veterans' tales, his worldview crumbled. He began to ask questions he had not asked before. He began to think, and thinking within any military establishment is an act of subversion.
He soon decided he did not want to be part of an organization that routinely snuffed out the lives of unarmed people, including children. He applied in February 2014 for a classification known as conscientious objector. He instantly became a pariah within his unit. No one wanted to associate with him. He was taunted as a traitor, coward, faggot, and hippie. He was assigned to the most demeaning jobs on the base, and the military bureaucracy began making him jump through hoops that he's still trying to negotiate 2 years later. He became an example to his fellow soldiers of the physical and emotional harassment, as well as humiliation, that is visited on all who dare within the military to challenge the sanctity of war and discipline.
I feel as if my own government is torturing me, he said, when reached by phone in his barrack at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Weilbacher, 27, grew up in poverty, raised by a single mother in the inner city of Columbus, Ohio. As a student at The Ohio State University, where he was a political science and English major, he started two organizations to help feed the homeless. He was an idealist. He wanted to serve humanity. And in the warped culture in which he lived, American culture, the best way to do that was to join the military, which was organized, he thought, around noble ideals. The public perception, including at Ohio State, which has a big ROTC program, is that soldiers are heroic, he said. They're serving their country. They're in the best army in the world. I didn't question this. I watched the commercials with the climatic background music for the Marine Corps. The few, the proud, the Marines. The Marines have the biggest masculine factor. I thought, I have the credentials to be a Marine officer. Every message given to me by popular culture was that violence was a means of conflict resolution, he said.
This was especially true in the inner city where I grew up and where there is a lack of education. Video games such as Call of Duty normalize violence. You don't realize the impact it has. Your conscience is subverted. In Call of Duty, you get rewarded for killing. You rank up in the system. The message is if you like Call of Duty, you'll like the military. And, of course, the military also incentivizes killing. If you do well at marksmanship, you get rewarded with three-day passes. You only think about the points you can get from becoming an expert marksman. You don't think about the act of taking a human life. Every aspect of popular culture incentivizes violence, from television shows to movies like American Sniper. Killing is presented as noble. Those who kill are supposed to be heroes, and this prepares us for the military. When he graduated from college, he signed up for Marine Officer Candidate School and was sent to Quantico, Virginia for boot camp. When we marched in formation, we shouted out cadences, he said. Most of the cadences were about killing. We shouted, kill, kill, kill. We shouted, what makes the green grass grow? Blood, blood, blood. We shouted, AT&T, reach out and touch someone. The intent of OCS was to normalize violence, to condition us. It was very effective. Again, I didn't think about what I was doing. All I was thinking about was being a Marine Corps officer.
But 4 weeks into his training in early 2012, he was injured and had to drop out. He was devastated. He did not want to begin the whole application process again with the Marines, and he enlisted in the Army in April 2013. He went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma for basic training. He was then trained as a medic at Fort Sam Houston, Texas. He enrolled in airborne school at Fort Benning, Georgia, and during the second week of training was injured during a practice for landing falls. In December 2013, he was deployed to Camp Hovey in South Korea, 10 miles from the border with North Korea. He was attached as a medic to the 4-7 Cavalry. He began to hear disturbing stories about the wars in the Middle East. Not the glorified stories spun out by recruiters, the media, or the entertainment industry, but stories about whole families being blown up or gunned down by U.S. troops in the streets of Iraq and Afghanistan. He lived among soldiers who were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Many were drinking heavily. He listened to them talk about being prescribed antidepressants by Army doctors and then being redeployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. He may have been a medic, but he was required to carry a weapon and to use it in combat. He knew that for him, to do so would be impossible.
I joined the military because I wanted to help people, to fight for the greater good, he said. And then I learned about innocent people being routinely blown up in war. I started researching the statistics on collateral damage in Iraq and Afghanistan. A medic in the Army weaponizes soldiers so they can go back out and kill, he said. When we're trained as medics, we're told that our task is to preserve fighting strength. Being a medic in the Army is not about helping the people who need it most. Treatment is first directed towards casualties that have the best chance to survive. Army medics exist to perpetuate warfare.
He discovered the Iraq Body Count website and was appalled by what he learned there. He began to devour the writings and statements of Martin Luther King Jr., Mahatma Gandhi, Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, the Reverend John Deere, Muhammad Ali, and the Dalai Lama. He could no longer watch violent movies or play violent video games. I began to read about the wars in Vietnam and World War II, he said. I read about Nagasaki, Hiroshima, Agent Orange, radiation, how it's still affecting people today, how people are still dying or being born with congenital defects. I found Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn. I had never heard of them. I guess there was a good reason I had never heard of them. I read A People's History of the United States by Zinn. I read Understanding Power by Chomsky. A lot of my influences, even though I'm an atheist, came from religious figures like Gandhi, Father John Deere, and King. I read Pilgrimage to Nonviolence. I know why they do not tell us the truth about war. We have a volunteer army. If people knew the truth, it would decrease the numbers who want to join. I had been betrayed.
Then in early February of 2014, he went online to the website of the Center on Conscience and War, led by Maria Santelli and Bill Galvin. Soon he contacted the two activists and told them he was a conscientious objector. Everything about the military culture, from its celebration of violence and hypermasculinity to its cult of blind obedience, began to disturb him.
Although Army regulations required that his application be sent to the Department of the Army Conscientious Objector Review Board, within 90 days. It took more than 200 days for the document to arrive there. On December 16, 2014, he was granted status as a conscientious objector and an honorable discharge, but the Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Army for Review Boards unilaterally overruled the DACORB determination and denied his application, even though Army regulation states that a review board decision is final. Now, in a final bid to achieve conscientious objector status, he has turned to the American Civil Liberties Union. I have obeyed the rules during the whole process, he said, but in the military, there is a double standard. If I do not obey the regulations, I get court-martialed. If they do not obey the regulations, nothing happens. It is I who suffers. If I lose this last bid, I cannot reapply. This will be his last bureaucratic battle with the Army. He has followed the rules for 2 years. He will not, he said, be in the Army in 2017 at the scheduled end of his tour.
If I'm forced to remain in the Army, I expect to eventually receive an order that I, as an objector, will be unable to comply with, resulting in a court-martial.
The above story is at Information Clearinghouse. It is entitled, Thou Shalt Not Kill. It is by Chris Hedges. That's all, folks. That's the news, and we are out of here. Good night and good luck, and so it goes. That's the way it is. Stay on the same page. Take it to the next level. It is what it is. At the end of the day, have a good day, and remember to always tip your congressman. Our next guest of the evening is Susan Lindauer. Chuck will be getting Susan on the phone soon. Susan comes to us each month from Tacoma Park, Maryland.
Hi, this is Susan. I'm not available right now. Please leave your name and number, and I'll get back to you as I can. Thanks.
Well, let's try that again.
Okay.
I hope we'll get Susan.
Yep, we hope so.
Hi, this is Susan. I'm not available right now. Please leave your name and number, and I'll get...
Well, Mike, I wasn't able to get hold of her earlier either before the show. I usually try to warn our guests, so we're going to have to do something else.
I wonder. She did... Well, okay. She did respond to the reminder I sent out, said that she would be ready, but I just, maybe she had something going on. Okay. Well, Chuck, we got to about 12 minutes here. What do you got?
Put me on the spot, don't you?
Yeah. We're going to talk about the weather, huh?
Yeah, right. I wonder if there's something of Susan's that we could read.
I'm not sure. She does have Susan Lindauer is a radio show host. She has her own radio show on Truth Frequency Radio. I don't have anything by her right now. I don't know. I don't think I could find anything by her quick. But I could, if you want to look for something, Chuck, I'll talk. I think I'll just...
Yeah, I'm looking, so go ahead and talk.
I'll just second what Jim Fetzer was saying about the book, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, and it is kind of an incredible thing, actually. We've been in the process of working on this book for over a year, and usually I suppose that might be a normal time frame for most books, but usually when you self-publish like this, you're able to get them out a little bit quicker, but that doesn't matter. We got it out, and it's doing very well. It's, it's just selling, and that's, to me, that's kind of incredible. Whenever I publish a lot of novels, and they're available on Amazon, and usually I find that my novels don't sell, and that's just a fact of it. And I keep trying, but they don't. But that's no matter. That is not either here or there. But what makes that's what makes me appreciate so much that this book is doing well. It's I don't know. I think we're getting close to 500 copies sold, and to me, that's very cool. And Jim Fetzer has done a lot of work on it. Holly Dalmagard, who is usually on this show in the first week of every month, he did the layout work. And Chuck Gregory helped us a lot with it. He kind of guided us through the publishing process, and he got it started. And so we are in the thick of getting this book out, and a lot of the publicity is being done by Jim Fetzer and Ole Dalgaard. They're doing a lot of radio interviews. It's part of a series. The first part book was The Dynamic Duel, and that was a biography of Fetzer and Barrett. And that came out a couple of years ago, and you can find The Dynamic Duel at Amazon. And I think that's a great book as well, although it hasn't done as well. It is, I think Fetzer and Barrett are very interesting people, and that's why I suggested that we do. Chuck and I work on a book on Jim Fetzer and Kevin Barrett, and so we did a bunch of interviews, and we put that book together. And I just think you would really enjoy reading about, in depth, about Fetzer and Barrett. They just have a lot to say about many things. And I often talk about how I think they are the cutting edge of the alternative media. And I believe that. I just think that, you know, you go, I don't know, I think you just get things from their radio shows. And they have many of them. There's one on Noise Radio. Jim has, he's had for years, The Real Deal. They're just not afraid. They're very well-read, very highly educated, and they're not afraid to say what the truth is. And I think that you don't find that in the standard alternative media. You can search for a long time. You can search all day, let's say, on the internet and trying to find the truth on the so-called liberal websites, and you will go to bed without finding the truth. You know, to be blunt, it just there. I don't know why. I don't know if it's this or that. You know, we can make our own suggestions, our own guesses at that. But with Fetzer and Barrett, you do find the truth, and that's why we put together that first book. And the second book, like I said, has been in process for a long, long time, and finally we got it out.
Mike, I tried again offline to contact Susan, and we just don't seem to be getting through. So,
okay.
You know, on another recent occasion, we had a phone accidentally turned off or off the hook or something. And since this is going immediately to a recording, I have a feeling it's something similar to that. Like it almost
so it must be a super nice if, day in Tacoma Park, Maryland, so she won't.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if you're a paranoid type, you'd start thinking that somebody's interfering with our guests. But of course, we're not paranoid, so we don't think that.
No, I don't really think that at all. I think that she just.
I don't either. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think we're important enough to mess with.
Yeah, exactly.
the next book in this series is going to be Nobody Died at Sandy Hook, and it's going to deal with supposed Sandy Hook school shooting where nobody died, and it's going to also deal with the Boston bombing where nobody died. So that book we're going to be working on ASAP, and we'll be getting that book out on the heels of it. I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. And to close out the four-book series, we have plans to put out a book on the 9/11, something new about 9/11. And hopefully we'll be able to get that out before Christmas, maybe even in the fall. It'll be awesome. And I suppose we didn't go to the moon either is, again, it's about how we didn't go to the moon. How the Holocaust is not as we have been led to believe. And it's also about Paul McCartney, how he died in the 1960s. And, you know,
this opportunity, Mike, I'd like to remind listeners that they can find all of our old episodes at our new website. That's http newdream.us. That's newdream.us. And it's a...
You just got that together new, didn't you?
Huh?
Didn't you just... That's something you just put that... That's new, isn't it, that you put together?
That's... I put it together within the last couple of months, yes. And trying to keep up with all the archives. Last week's show still isn't up. I haven't had time this week, but it'll be up soon. And then this week's show, hopefully before next week. So,
how long have we been doing this show, Chuck?
We've been doing this show a long time, Mike. What was it, February 3rd, 2011?
You know, yeah. You sure did. And we, you know, we've been from, we worked with Leno Stanek at Block Op Radio. Then we went to Blog Talk, right? And then now we've been with Revolution Radio since, will it be 2 years in December?
Yes, yes it will.
Right?
Yep.
And we are so glad to be at Revolution Radio, and they bring many listeners to us. Or vice versa. I'm not sure how that goes, but we get many, many, many listeners through Revolution Radio, and I'd like to hear from some of them. Email me at nwestiowa@gmail.com. What's your? You want to give your email address out, Chuck? Or not?
Sure. You can email me at cwg@cwgservices.com.
And you can tell us all the changes and improvements you want us to make, and
we'll do our best.
Okay. Now please join us as we look in on the new CBS reality TV show, One Day in the Life of an American Solzhenitsyn, a prisoner, an American prisoner, recently looked out from his prison window, a high prison window, in the middle of a big city, down on the little people and little cars below. Behind him on his coarse blanket on his bed, various newspapers and magazines were strewn about because he was allowed to have information coming in, just none going out. The dates on the papers and magazines were behind the times, but they did get there eventually. He was not allowed pencil or paper, but he was allowed to think. And as he did every day, he thought about the letter that he would send to everyone when he someday got the chance. He was for some reason sure that what he had to say would be news to those below, which it surely would be. Zero Dark Thirty, the big blockbuster American movie showing everywhere, nominated for Academy Awards. We have lots of American actors who should be nominated for Academy Awards. That guy who was shown on TV wearing a Harley shirt in the street in New York saying the buildings fell down due to jet fuel. The father of the Sandy Hook child. George Bush, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, all excellent actors. How about the actors reading the nightly news, the ones we listened to on TV the morning of September 11, 2001? Award-winning performances all. Well, let's see. The New American Dream, what is this all about? The most profound events in the history of mankind are the faking of the moon landings, the CIA overthrows of governments around the world, the murders of JFK, RFK, MLK, and Malcolm X, Oklahoma City, Waco, the control of the media, the whole subversive takeover of the U.S., and the spirit of the Soviet Union. While unlike the people of the Soviet Union, the Americans believe they are free, more profound than anything else in world history ever. Some say it's goofy, this stuff, not real conspiracy stuff, and yeah, I'll give you that. It can appear that way, but it's goofy only if you don't read anything. I suppose it's goofy sounding if your sense of reality comes from American Idol, Today's Best Kitchen, America's Biggest Hamburger, Brian Williams, Katie Couric, and Bill O'Reilly, Jim Lehrer. That's the way it was when I was a kid. We watched Gunsmoke, Bewitched, My Favorite Martian, The Flying Nun, Gilligan's Island, and that thought that was all we needed to know. So when they told us Lee Harvey Oswald killed JFK, and that James Earl Ray killed Martin Luther King and Sirhan killed RFK, we said, okay, and then went in the kitchen for an ice cream refill. my final realization about what this country is really about, what it has become, is when they ruled that Bush won the election by stopping the counting of votes. I realized, of course, they kill the Kennedys. They can do whatever they want. And you can say that's conspiracy tinfoil to think like that about the Bushes and assassinations and such. But I say it's just paying attention. And then there's the Obama election, believing in hope, openness, no wrong questions, truth, becoming the type of people nation that we always thought we were. It didn't happen. And we have to ask ourselves why. It's one of those questions that we are allowed to ask, that we should ask. You have to know that Barack Obama knows the whole truth about the 9/11 attacks. He is complicit. He has lied. He has continued the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan based on a lie, and he knows he is lying. Osama bin Laden was buried at sea. No prosecution of Bush and Cheney. Continued the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, expanding elsewhere. Nobel Peace Prize winner pleads. For what reason has he acted this way? Who knows? Some say his first job out of college was with the CIA. Do you ever leave the CIA? Ask William Buckley and Peter Matheson, Ben Bradley, Bob Woodward. I don't know. But based on Nuremberg or Common Sense or Snoopy or Calvin and Hobbes, Barack Obama is a criminal, just as George Bush and George Bush before him, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Condoleezza Rice, the whole bunch. And yet they go on living their normal lives. It's wrong and it's frustrating. I really deep down believe in this whole thing. To me, to know the truth about our history is the most important thing, period. If that can happen, I believe the rest takes care of itself. Gross legs, as they say. We pay for these lies. Some people struggling with two or three jobs, this lie that the military protects us, this lie that the USA stands for freedom, this lie that it's okay to kill. There is actually a they out there. There actually is a you and a me and a we. They, Bush, Obama, Clinton, and company, want us to be afraid, as they told us in the anthrax letters in 2001. We can do this, but we cannot be afraid. The American prisoner turned from the window as he heard familiar clatter in the hallway. The guard stuck his meal tray through the slot, and the prisoner exchanged greetings with the guard, took his tray to sit on his bed to eat. Join us next week on One Day in the Life of an American Soldier in Itzen, where we will see the American prisoner thinking about who really are the terrorists and who really are the freedom fighters and stuff like that. Well, it's been another long week in Newtown, my hometown at the end of the empire. It's time for the publication of the new sophomore history textbook, The Bread and Butter of 3D1K Publishing House, managed by Nico Stados Greenberg in Newtown. Seems nobody is paying much attention to history these days. What is he to do? Well, he's running all over the grounds to talk to people to figure things out, for one thing. We find him now headed to talk to his daughters, one a teacher at the public school, the other who homeschools her kids.
Finally arrived at the summit, the flat area of town, and he smelled the burning leaves, heard the children playing, felt the apple pie breeze on his cheek. Nick stopped at the four-way and stood as drivers stopped, looked at him, kept going. Others stopped, waited for him to cross, gunned it through the intersection. Nick stood with his hands in his pockets, staring at the big brick school where his one daughter taught sophomore American History 101. And over on the apple pie side of the street, another daughter played with her homeschool children in the front yard, tossing a ball. Why couldn't he just quit? Keeping his hands in his pockets, he shuffled his feet around like Charlie Chaplin to survey down that direction. He's old, been at this a long time, but never before like this. Not with the sophomore history textbook debacle that would follow him around in his mind forever wherever he went, fishing, to get beans, to the ball game, to the memorial cemetery up behind City Hall. He needed something new, something big, something that people would see and say, yes, that's interesting, and tell others. And then Nick could wave as he walked out the door of his big, hugely successful retirement party and head right for an old fishing boat, and perhaps disappear over the horizon. triumph of the blah, blah, blah nation. Make up some crap. He shuffled another 90 degrees and smiled. Somebody he knew waved and Nick stuck up his chin. He shuffled again, saw young people driving with their heads down, working their phones. People do not read. Washington, Lincoln, Jefferson, are you kidding me? They should put a rock star, a football player, a famous chef on the cover. That actually might work. Go supersize or go home. The paranormal pageant. The reptilian republic. Land of greed. My big fat country. Nick waved to a woman his age who was stopping for him and stepped into the street when he was sure. He ducked his head to walk, which made it easy to hit the opposite curb perfectly and not stumble. He stopped at the intersections of the sidewalks. He waved at the school, at the window up on the third floor, with his daughter now hanging out. Hey, Papa! The homeschool daughter now also saw him. He waved with both hands. He gulped a deep breath, as if it were gold, and so it choked him. He leaned over and grabbed his knees, causing his daughter to lean farther out the window and brush hands down the apron and put one hand on the gate. He raised up, waved again both hands. I'm all right. Like Kennedy, he needed to make peace with the Ruskies. He needed to go against the old guard, make the world new. It would not be easy, but it must be done even if it killed him. It must be done. He crossed Kitty Corner over the street without looking, causing a pickup to stop quick. Nick smiled, put up a hand like the mayor in the pageant parade, headed for the school building. Out of the corner of his eye, he watched the homeschool daughter watching him with hands on hips as she fast walked over the school front lawn, head down, fists tight and pumping. He kicked through the plastic soda containers and cigarette packs surrounding the statue that was a replica of the one right in front of the publishing house main office. He entered the old school as if entering a Jimmy Breslin column, a cathedral, sacred space, where he went three times a week religiously until his sophomore year. A door slammed a block away. Nick stood like a rabbit whose one weapon is stillness. His nose wiggled, brought back hamburgers and strawberry drink. His ears stretched to catch the direction of inherent danger. Over there. Nick saw a hand on the corner wall and headed up the shine, painted gray cement steps to the upperclassmen areas he'd never seen. Up, up, around, around, sliding his hand on the shine-painted gray smooth rail. He heard authoritative, nitpicky, fussy, critical, nagging steps behind him and closing in. He leaned forward to climb faster, swiped off his Yankees cap and wiped his forehead with his arm. He stopped and looked up. There she was, the girl of his dreams, nice, everything, long, everything, everything smooth. He gripped the shiny railing as if one hand was enough to keep him from falling off the face of the earth. She took the middle of the steps, smiling at him, commanding each shine step as if it were her own, while bluebirds and bees fluttered about her, making sure everything was just so, finding they had nothing to do. She stopped on the same step. They looked into each other's eyes, and somewhere, somebody played Neil Diamond, Simon and Garfunkel, four of Bread's greatest hits. And The Carpenters, her concern was legit. She furrowed her brow, moved in closer, gently took Nick's arm and asked if he was all right, if he needed help finding the door. "Do you know where you are?" she said. Behind him, around just a couple of turns, came the resolute steps. Nick nudged free of the teen angel and pulled himself up by the railing. Up, up, around, around. Nick arrived at the top floor. This must be it. He glanced around, snatched off his cap, and peeked around again. Nobody in sight. But the footsteps behind just kept coming, like the posse on the trail of Sundance and Butch. Shoosh, whoosh, shoosh. He flattened his back against the lockers and shuffled down the hall, grimacing at each locker handle in his back. He came to the door, stuck his head around. "Hello, Father." He looked back. There she was, across the hall. The steps behind him rounded the corner, and now more coming from the other end of the long, shiny hall. The principal, Miss Bordeaux, approached him, concerned with papers in her hands. "Good morning, Mr. Greenberg," she said, as she handed his daughter something and moved on, her shoes clicking. She passed Sonny. The janitor headed this way. Sonny also worked part-time at the plant. Sonny was the shooter who always shot the actor in the opening scene shooting thing to begin historical days. Sometimes he dressed like Lee Oswald. Sometimes James Earl Ray or Sir Hans Rahan or the guy who shot Reagan. Once the woman who tried to murder Gerald Ford. But now, since Blaze Thornpine had actually been killed, how was Sonny not in jail then? Nick thought that he needed to check with the big shoot staff to ask what was going on with it. "Hey, Mr. Nick," Sonny said as he passed and also nodded to Nick's daughter. "I think the coast is clear," she said, uncrossing her arms and turning sideways to welcome him over. "Hey, Katie," he said. Mrs. Beantree." She smiled again and quick waved him over like a traffic cop with a pokey driver. He pressed his cap into his stomach. "Really?" He'd never been in a sophomore history classroom. "Yes," she said. "It's about time, too." He pushed his back into the side wall, the chalkboard, chalk tray, sending a ruler and a flag clattering to the floor. He hurried to pick them up. "Sorry," he said. She helped him and gripped his arm. "This is my father," she said to the class. The students watched him. He watched them. Katie led him to the front of the room and brought him a wooden bar stool to perch front and center. "This is familiar," he mumbled. "I'll listen." "You go ahead, whatever you was doing, go on." "Well, actually," she said, "since I saw you coming across the lawn, we've been waiting for you. It's new book time." "Well, yes," he said. "Well, maybe you could tell us about the new textbook, the new Sophomore History 101 text that your company will be producing, printing in the very near future." "It's a big deal. Most of this town has a connection, if not directly to the plant, then by way of children using the text and learning about America." She hustled in and pinched his arm. "And besides, we got some extra time before lunch." She stepped back, tossed out both arms. "Nicostatus Greenberg, if you would not mind." She clapped with her hand stretched out long, and the children followed politely. Katie grabbed the current book from her desk and handed it to her dad. He held it in his lap, looked at the front cover, back cover, photos on the back, all on a red, white, and blue background base. Well, yeah, Jeff. He looked up and saw a full room, full faces, all looking right at him. Stay on the same page, he said. Take it to the next level. I know, right? He ran his thumb quickly through the book, feathering all 713 pages. What do you think, he said. You like history? He smiled back at his daughter and waved a hand at her. Forget she's here. We were kind of hoping to hear about the new book, said Katie. Yeah, yeah. He swiveled to her and then back. That's the thing, see? Something's not working. People aren't really reading these freaking things. Sorry, he said over his shoulder without looking. Nick saw in his classroom mostly white kids. There were two that could be Mexican, he thought. One black girl for sure. One Indian or Asian kid by the window. You read this book? He turned to his daughter. Yes, we follow it page by page, and the study guides and questions at the end of each chapter are very helpful. I was an advisor one summer to your writing department, Papa, if you recall. Yeah, yeah. You. He pointed at the Mexican kids and the black kid and the Indian Asian something kid. Stand up. They looked at each other, slowly pushed themselves to the edge of their desks, and glacially stood. You like this book? Two of the children shrugged their shoulders. One shook her head. One giggled, turning red behind her hand. Okay, sorry. You can sit. He dropped the book flat on the floor and it banged. The students jumped. That's the most excitement you ever got in this class, huh? He looked at his daughter and she scowled back. Okay, I gotta go. He climbed off his stool, pointed one gun hand at his daughter, the other at the students. Stay on the same page. Katie stayed standing by her desk, watching him, arms folded now across her chest as he went to the door. He waved again with his cap and entered the hallway, where he saw Principal Miss Bordeaux standing with her back against the locker. She walked with him as he moved past. It's not just here, she said. I'll be at the sales meeting, but we won't be ordering a new text, she said. It's just not worth it. There's nothing new year to year. I mean, history is history, right? And the cost, well, we need basketball uniforms for the girls. It's been 7 years. He walked round and round, his head up, looking at the black and white photos every now and then on the walls. Jefferson, Washington, Lincoln, a flag, a teacher's desk, an apple. Now Washington again. He stopped to sit on the statue and smoke his cigar. Nodding at some kids hustling inside, he twisted the cigar out on the statue, stuck it into his coat pocket, and walked over to see Janie, who he hadn't always gotten along with the greatest every single freaking time. He always tried to do the big family thing with the big table and the big happy talk, but it never worked that well that he could actually remember. As you might imagine, in a family like the Greenbergs, history might be a big topic of conversation, but it wasn't. It was more that the business of publishing history textbooks for sophomores in high school was kept at arm's length. Janie always wanted to pull it in close. Nick guessed he had not encouraged that. He crossed the street, stepped up over the curb onto the terrace, swung open the squeaky front gate, bent to move a yellow plastic automobile from the sidewalk, and left it. It was no use. The whole yard was scattered with primary colored plastic toys. He stepped over the little car, made his way up the broken cement steps to the loose metal screen door. He stepped up over the little car and made his way up over the broken cement steps to the loose metal screen door.
And that's the news from Newtown, where all the police and soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats and journalists are cowards, and all the Homeland Security, COINTELPRO lone gunmen are about average.
And that wraps up another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We thank you for joining us tonight. We hope you'll be back next week and every week right here. The New American Dream Radio Show, streaming live every Thursday, 6 to 8 p.m. from Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Thank you, Mike, and good night.
And thanks to our guests, Jim Fetzer, Richard Flamer, and sorry we had to miss Susan Lindauer, but we'll see her next month, I'm sure. To get the archives of the show from February 2011, go to theshow.newamericandream.info. And as always, we apologize for our mistakes and plan to make fewer mistakes next week. To contact the show, either Chuck or me or any of our guests, write to me at nwestiowa@gmail.com. And as always, we wish to acknowledge the work of South Dakota stone artisan Borglum Borglumson as he works to make over Mount Rushmore, put the real face of American history up there in stone. Lee Harvey Oswald, Sirhan Sirhan, Mark David Chapman, and James Earl Ray. Follow the ongoing project at looserock.com, rollingstones.com, and jackrubyrubyridge.com. And so good night to my friends Chuck and Lorraine. Stay warm down there. Good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. Good night, Mark Bingham. Good night, Daniel Lewin. Good night, Ken Lay. Good night, Timothy McVeigh. Good night, Lumley Parker. Good night, Ben Wheeler. Good night, Crystal Campbell. Good night, Nancy Lanza. Good night, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff. Good night, Charlie Hebdo. Good night, Mohammed Atta. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.